This is Phil Cousineau. Who stole the arms of the Venus de Milo? The myth of beauty from Aphrodite to Ansel Adams. October 14th, 2011. There were a few images here on the DVD. Most of them Phil asked us not to include.
I'd like to welcome back our speaker, Phil Cousineau. You've probably seen him before when he was here for The Art of Pilgrimage. We talked about Joseph Campbell's life and work, the documentary that he was involved in, and then also he was here for Stoking the Creative Fires. So Phil is a writer, filmmaker, photographer, and adventure travel leader. In fact, he just returned from leading a literary tour of Ireland and is going to be leading a tour to Greece next year. So there's information on the back table if you're interested in going. He's also written books on, besides Stoking the Creative Fire, The Art of Pilgrimage, Word Catcher, several books of poetry, and Once and Future Myths. Some of these books are in the back. You can buy them tonight and have him sign them. And his books have been translated into languages and are distributed all over the world. So currently he's the host of the nationally televised series Global Spirit, which is on Link TV, and if you haven't seen it yet, you have to go and look at it. And soon it will be appearing on PBS stations. And on Sunday, there will be a Global Spirit Salon at East West Bookstore. So please check that out. And his upcoming book is the inspiration for this week's presentation, Who Stole the Arms of the Venus de Milo? So please welcome Phil Cousineau back.
Well, thank you, Shirley. Thank you for the invitation to come back. Thank you, Seattle. Thank you for sending us Doug Pfister all the way to Detroit for the Tigers. We love him there. I hope you don't miss him too much. There'll be a lot of baseball metaphors mixed into tonight's talk. Bear with me. Wonderful to be back. I'm in a wonderful hotel. I'm in the 15th floor overlooking the city and the mountains and remembering my father was out here for the World's Fair in 1962 representing Ford Motor Company. He worked for Ford all his life. And he always told me, if I ever retire, Philip, I'm going to retire to Seattle. So I thought of him when I stared out the window looking at some notes for tonight. Now, let's start on a note of synchronicity. Synchronicity lives, right? I love reading about it, writing about it. So I head to the airport, pick up my San Francisco Chronicle, and the first thing that I find in the datebook section, which describes the music and the movies coming out for the weekend, was a little article in here called Public Eavesdropping, and two teenage girls were overheard at the Louvre, apparently just recently, one of them saying to the other, "Oh, look, there's the no arm thingy." Who would have guessed, right? Wonderful, wonderful. The no arm thingy. Only an American teenager. So, since I'm going to be telling stories about my long affair, don't tell my wife, my long affair with this beautiful girl from Paris/Greece, I want to start with a poem story by Robert Penn Warren. It's called Tell Me a Story. And it should set the mood for the evening. Long ago in Kentucky, I, a boy, stood by a dirt road in first dark and heard the great geese hoot northward. I could not see them, there being no moon and the stars being sparse, but I heard them. I didn't know what was happening in my heart. It was the season before the elderberry blooms. Someone told me there's an elderberry in the yard here. Synchronicity lives, right? Therefore, they were going south, and the sound was passing northward. Tell me a story. In this century and moment of mania, tell me a story. Make it a story of great distances and starlight. The name of the story will be Time, but you must not pronounce its name. Tell me a story of deep delight. Robert Penn Warren, just magnificent. There's a song there, isn't there? There's a song there. And to get us even closer into the theme of the evening. A second note, which I found over the last now 14 years of doing research on this book, in the middle of all my other films and books and the TV show now. And this is from Alexander Solzhenitsyn's 1970 Nobel Prize for Literature acceptance speech. And it gives us a little gravitas on the side of delight that is so permeates the story of Aphrodite Venus. And this is from the emerging book, which should be available in a year or so, Who Stole the Arms of the Venus de Milo? In 1945, the Russian writer Solzhenitsyn was arrested for criticizing Stalin in private letters and sentenced to 8 years of harsh labor in Siberia. During the brutal forced marches across the freezing tundra, he composed long speeches, vowing that he would someday deliver them to the outside world. 17 years and several epic books later, Solzhenitsyn received a letter from Stockholm. The Nobel Committee informed him he had just been awarded the prize for literature for his depiction of the monstrosity of life inside of the Gulag archipelago. When Solzhenitsyn stood at the podium and spoke to that August audience, he only briefly referred to what he called the millstone of surveillance and disgust in the camps. Instead, he cited a mysterious passage from Dostoevsky's The Idiot, where Prince Myshkin says, "Beauty will save the world." Then Solzhenitsyn paused and asked, "What does that mean?" For a long time, I thought that was just a phrase. How could that be possible? When in our bloodthirsty history did beauty save whom from what? Beauty has ennobled us. Sometimes it's elevated us, yes, but whom has it ever saved? Arguing for the peculiar power in art, Solzhenitsyn went on to say, what's powerful about it is that art can vanquish the lie. The lie that says culture doesn't matter. He goes on to say, that's what I think, my friends, that we are capable of helping the world in its agonizing, testing hour right now, because one word of truth outweighs the whole world. The truth in art and literature, he concluded, is so utterly, irrefutably convincing, it may even straighten out the twisted roads of history. The beautiful but tough truth, he said, helps us transcends our suffering, which means beauty helps us survive. Alexander Solzhenitsyn. So then, with that little introduction, the cause of my last many years, in many ways, this book, this project, is a confluence of my love of mythology through my work with Joseph Campbell, but also the work I'm doing with Houston Smith right now. I'm helping him finish his memoirs, which is a great, great honor. 92, he's finally weaving his stories together. Magnificent. But my love of history, my love of art and travel, all of that is coming together in this one book. So the Arms of the Venus de Milo, the Myth of Beauty, from Aphrodite to Ansel Adams. That comes from a talk I gave at Yosemite, the keynote talk for Ansel's centenary, 2004, at Yosemite. So I was invited for the keynote. What they didn't tell me was that they had invited 200 of the world's greatest photographers. And here I'm rabbiting on about the myth of beauty from Aphrodite. Oh, boy, if I knew they were out there, I wouldn't have been able to get through the talk. So, as Robert Colasso in his magnificent book, The Marriage of Cadmus and Harmony, says, all myths are stories about where it all began. Sacred stories. Everybody, everything, every people, every corporation, Apple Computer, Steve Jobs, rest in peace, they all have their own mythologies. Mine begins here. That's my sister. Just talked to her on the phone a few minutes ago. We're at the Ford Rotunda in Detroit celebrating Christmas. You see here, my father played Santa Claus, so every year he knew exactly what I wanted for Christmas until the year I recognized his watch. And I said, you're not Santa. And here I am reading. And I show you this because for a couple of reasons. One, this is part of my own self-mythology here, of course. I vividly remember trying to look intelligent and interested and focused for my father as he snapped the brownie camera photo of me right there. And of course, this little book is upside down. But what's important was that he knew that I was reading. And the reason it was important is because we grew up in a family, if you know my books, I write about this a lot, we read books out loud together. Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights, three nights a week. The classics, from the Iliad and the Odyssey up through Grimm's fairy tales, all the way up to literature. Moby Dick, Mutiny on the Bounty, Mark Twain. So I grew up in a world of art. My father had a poster of this great painting of Venus and Mars above his workbench in the basement. So here's a guy who worked at Ford Motor Company 5 days a week, but he loved art and reading, took us to museums every weekend. We would drive to Toledo, Cincinnati, New York to go to art exhibitions. So I grew up with the world, very proud of Detroit, but the car industry, books, travel, and my French heritage. So when I left Detroit with a degree in journalism in the early 70s, my first stop was Paris. And I've been going there almost every year ever since, about 30-odd years now. And in 1997, after leading a tour around Paris, I had a few days off before I had to come home. So I went to the Louvre in my day off, of course, had to go to the museum. And I saw this poster, and it reminded me of my father and the Venus de Milo. So I followed the poster into the room, which happens to be, if you know your history and all, there's the wonderful statue of the Venus, and these are the old chambers of the Queen of France. It's a curiosity. Well, a lot of things will circle back on themselves, like the Ouroboros here, how and why she ended up in this little niche here in the world's greatest, most extensive museum. So I'm there with a crowd at first, as there always is, and then they leave, and there was a mysterious moment. I was all alone with the Venus de Milo, and this hardly ever happens. Along with the Mona Lisa, it's the most visited work of the, what do they sell, 8 million pieces of art in the Louvre. It's astonishing, the collection they have. And while I'm standing there alone, I hear a little girl shuffle up with her mother in this sweet little Irish voice. She says, "Mama, mama, mama, who stole the arms of the Venus de Milo?" And the first thing that came to me was, what a great book title. And ever since, I've been trying to wedge the book into that title. Right. And then she said the sweetest thing. As they were walking away, she said, "Nobody stole them, sweetheart. I think they used to make them that way." Isn't that brilliant? And then I remember walking around it and being astonished, as if I was looking at it, at her, for the first time, wandering around, fascinated, in love with the body, the torso, but really, it was the face. And I've come to believe, after many years of working on this now, her face is the sculpture's equivalent of the Mona Lisa. And I'm looking at her, and I'm wondering, what is she looking at? And that then becomes the origin of this whole book and the talk tonight. Who is she? What's the fuss about? Why is she so famous? Along with Michelangelo's David or David, probably the most famous statue in the world. But looking at her face, I've wanted to know the story. What's the story behind her? How did she get here? What is she looking at? What is that poignant secret that she has? That's enough to fuel a book. You have to love what you're writing about. Otherwise, you will find a way to drop it. As Stephen King said in his very humble book, after he was almost killed by a hit-and-run accident, he wrote a wonderful book on writing. He said, if you don't love it, drop it, because you could hurt somebody. This is Stephen King talking. You have to take that seriously. And I think what he means by that is you get frustrated, and you can turn out to be a really mean human being if you get stuck in your work. you've reached that point when you walk into a room and all the animals and children leave the room because you've walked in. You know there's some bad vibes going on around you in the room. So, a few thoughts on beauty as we look at her. Aristotle always considered it to be the key to the well-lived life. He said, life is not enough. Life is magnificent. Life is not enough. The goal of Greek life and the goal of the Greek genius, I believe, is the approach to arete, the life of excellence, the well-lived life. So he always talked about the beautiful and the good, not just beauty or just the good, but beauty and the good. Sappho, one of the great writers of all time, all the poetry we have of her comes, by the way, from wrappings around Egyptian mummies. That's the only way we have any of her poetry. Nothing existed until they started actually saving the mummies in Egypt. You know, they used to be used to stoke the fires of locomotives in Egypt and all across the Mediterranean. And then around the period we're going into to study this, they started, somebody somewhere along the line saw some writing on the strips around the mummies, and they said, oh, that looks Greek. So they started unraveling the tape, and what they had done was take reams and reams of books and poetry, papyrus, all papyrus, and they realized that some of this was actually quite beautiful. That's how we have her poetry. In one of her great lines, she says, I met beauty today, and I was overwhelmed by it, but my life was enriched. And we don't know quite what she saw, but just those lines, they felt like they could have been written today. Maybe you writing something about your children or the sunset today. Confucius says, beauty is everywhere, but we don't always notice it. There's a couple more. Keats, of course, beauty is truth, truth is beauty. Buckminster Fuller, I did a film on him in 1995 on ecological design, and he said he knew when a theory was right and ready to be executed, let's say one of his car designs or the design of a house, when the theory itself looked beautiful. Beauty was, as a scientist, his demarcation. Aquinas gives us the three great notions that so much influenced James Joyce and then later Joe Campbell, that beauty has to have integrity. In other words, everything fits in. You remove one word of a poem, one piece out of a mosaic, and everything falls apart. So there's integrity. Beauty has to have some radiance. It glows from within. Glow is a word we're going to go back to again and again. And radiates. And clarity. There has to be something crystal clear that comes through. Garbo has a great quote here. I'll read to you. Being a movie star means being looked at from every possible direction. You're never at peace. You're always fair game for the camera. Isn't that mysterious? Rumi says, when we have totally surrendered to beauty, we become a mighty kindness. Isn't that a great phrase? It's a great, great phrase. Darwin once wrote, that tale of the peacock, it makes me sick. Because he hadn't quite determined yet what role beauty had in evolution. And he later ended up writing about it, and he thought that beauty was actually a signal. It can actually accelerate evolution. But when he was young, it said it made him sick because it didn't fit into his theory. Elaine Scarry, if you want to read one book on beauty that you could read in an evening, it would be hers. It's simply called On Beauty, and it's Elaine and Scarry, Scarry, as you see here. And she has four very brief qualifications. Number one, beauty is unprecedented. You have never seen a face like hers before, and that's why you walk across the crowded room, like in the song. You've never heard a symphony like you heard Beethoven's Ode to Joy. You've never seen a blue like in Vermeer's painting. So there's something always startling, always a little surprising, a little jarring about beauty in that realm. Beauty is also, she says, life-saving. There's a signal, and she gets this notion from Rilke, when Rilke looks at that beautiful archaic torso of Apollo and says, you must change your life. Scarry says there's something about looking at real beauty or hearing it or seeing it that makes you, pushes you off of your current orbit and makes you feel that you need some change. Okay. With that little intro, on April 8th, 1820, on the little island of Milos, here in the Cyclades, named because these are the islands that circle around Delos, which was the site of the treasury, but it's also where Apollo and Artemis were born. So all the islands that circle around that are called the Cyclades. And on April 8th, 1820, well, I'll go back just a second here. There was, in the first century BC, as there was throughout antiquity all over Greece, there was a competition. The tiny island of Milos said, we need a statue. We want a statue for one of our civic buildings of Aphrodite. They would have called her Aphrodite, of course. And so the hue and cry went out. The messengers went out all across the Greek islands, and there was a great competition for a statue of Aphrodite or Venus to go to this island. The reason that that's important is because I believe it's one of the single greatest keys to understanding the Greek miracle, if you would. Think about this for a second. Every poem, the few paintings, the bits and pieces of poetry and songs, every statue, bronze and marble, came down to us because of a competition. If you think Americans are wild, crazy competition competitors about sports or Oscars or record contracts, we can't hold a candle to the ancient Greeks. They had competitions for everything. At the Olympics, in Olympia, there were 3 days of competitions in drama, theater, philosophy, oratory, drinking competitions, kissing competitions, beauty competitions for men and for women. Once you got through all of those, then you got to the games. And then there were 3 days of games. So the thought there was that human beings are inherently lazy. And what sharpens us, sharpens our sensibility, is the notion of a competition. Not simply to beat the other guy, and think of all the martial verbs often find in the sports pages, we're going to destroy the 49ers, right, Seahawks fans, right? Think of those verbs that we use. They tend to be so aggressive. But the Greeks had this other notion. You're going up, you're competing against somebody else because they will push you more than you will push yourself. They will push you to sharpen and hone your edge so you can be a better you. You can reach this this notion of arete, A-R-E-T-E, which is the single one word you need to understand this Greek miracle. And because of that, we had beautiful buildings. Every building that was built then and the ruins that we have now were built in competitions. All architecture, everything. And then, as our good old friend Joe Campbell used to say, and then Theodosius came along through 393 AD, and he sent out this edict that all pagan sites across the Roman Greek Empire were to be destroyed. You can date it exactly to 393. Everything was pagan. They had to shut the athletic competitions, the gyms. Why? Because all sports were performed naked. That's what the word gymnasium means. It means the place where you perform naked. And this shocked Theodosius. So they shuddered, they destroyed the sites. This is Olympia. This is the site of the Temple of Zeus. I'm sorry, this is a little too bright. Can these lights come down by any chance? That's better. So this was the Temple of Zeus. And right here was the statue of Zeus, which was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Phidias was the great sculptor for this, a huge influence on the statue we're going to be talking about. But in this sense, this for 1,500 years, most of antiquity, one of the greatest civilizations in the world, disappeared. This site was actually covered over by river silt, and it wasn't discovered again. Ancient Olympia, the greatest site of antiquity, was lost to the world for 1,500 years. And this is important to understand as we get into the story of the Venus. Because in the late 1790s, the Germans, the British, the French were all digging all over Greece. And the name at the time was an antiquarian. You were an antiquarian if you were looking for old ruins, maybe little statues or figurines. It was an adventure. It was part of being on the grand tour. It was a way to educate yourself, but being on site and going and touching the antiquity. So here is a wonderfully named Olivier Vautier. He was a French naval captain stationed on Melos on April 8th, 1820. And one day, on this particular day, he got a couple of sailors from the ship, the Estevet, and said, today's Sunday, we're going to go out and we're going to look for some statues. So they got some shovels and some picks and a wheelbarrow, and they started walking down from where they were stationed up here in the Castro, and they began walking down here. Why here? This is the old theater, the ruins of the old theater. Really an amphitheater. Magnificent plays were performed here. And up here was the ruins of the temple. And then over here is where we're going to end up. And this configuration is enormously important for the story. Here's a little close-up of the amphitheater. It's recently restored. You can see the marble seats there. And Vautier also knew that a magnificent statue of Poseidon had just been found. I didn't realize this until I was in the National Archaeological Museum in Athens, and I looked at the caption, as I always do, and it said the Poseidon of Melos. And then I did some research and found out that this was one of dozens of beautiful marble statues that had been erected all around the theater. So Vautier, being a good French sailor and scholar, hearkened himself down the hill and began digging with a couple of sailors in this little field. Yorgos Konstantinos was a local peasant who owned this land. So they're digging around here, hoping to get lucky, because if you get lucky, then you could get rich. You could get famous if you found something. And he heard the unmistakable sound of a shovel hitting marble. He wrote about this 50 years later in his journals. He knew the sound that it made. And what he heard was the sound of a shovel hitting the statue that we're thinking about. And I have just found this wonderful word. You know, my last book, Word Catcher, is on word origins, so I'm always on the look for it. The find spot is an archaeological term to describe where you actually find something. Isn't that wonderful? Another book title. I love that word. This is the find spot. So he darts over there, and he enters into a small cave. And there is a local peasant, Yorgos, who's actually been digging around in the cave. And the first thing that hits the French naval officer's mind is, oh, my God, the guy's found a statue, but we have to save it. Because, I don't know if you knew this, but there were... The guesstimate is that ancient Greece produced about 200,000 marble statues. 200,000. And there are only half a dozen of them left. The statues that you see are almost in museums are almost all Roman copies. Because if a statue was popular, you had 30, 40 copies commissioned of them. But most of them were destroyed. Why? Because up until the late 18th and early 19th century, people didn't think about history the way we do, so they ended up in lime kilns. Hundreds of thousands of statues. You would heat the marble up and produce whitewash to paint your houses. So the next time you're in Greece and you look at the white paint on the side of the house, you can go up and embrace it and say, Venus, what happened to you? You don't look the same. Right? So this was in Vautier's mind. He knew that a lot of the statues ended up in the lime kilns. And so he turned on a lamp, and this is what he saw. This is what had been uncovered in this cave. The top half of the Venus de Milo, the Venus of Milos. And he immediately said, keep digging, keep digging. The rest of her must be here somewhere, right? And then... Yorgos' eyes must have dilated a little bit because he knew that when you found something on the island there, you could get a little money for it. So he asked for some money, and Boutier actually gave him something like 400 piastres, which was the currency of the time, and they kept digging. And look what else they found. This is what used to be called a herm in honor of Hermes, and these were erected at crossroads all across the ancient world. This particular one is for Hercules, or Heracles, really, as they would have said. And if you see this little slot right here, forgive my French, but a phallus would have been there originally. So these were also icons of fertility. This is what you would see when you went to the crossroad. It would be a statue of Hermes because he was the god of travel, the god of commerce, a god of fertility. And so they found a herm of Hermes himself there, one of each of them, and they found a statue. No head, but a beautiful statue of Hermes. Now, this is where it starts getting delicious for me. Boutier is educated in the Napoleonic tradition, which means that if you are representing France and you discover something, you either write about it or you draw it or you sketch it. You might write down music if you're in a Morocco bazaar. You record it. This was part of Napoleon's genius. He never went on any military campaign without artists, architects, the equivalent of cameras or film crews in those days. You recorded. That's why we have those beautiful engravings of the Sphinx, for example, from Egypt, from his Egyptian campaign. All of those early lithographs and engravings and drawings come from that tradition. We are on a warpath, but at least we're going to write about it, right? So Boutier actually gets out his pencil, and within seconds, he draws a pretty good likeness of the Venus, right? And you can see right away that she doesn't have any arms. They did find pieces of the left arm, and as you'll see in a few minutes, a few other pieces. But right here, no arms were present. And we'll come back to that. It gets exciting. When they kept digging the next day, they found the lower half. They also found an inscription here, which is part of the whole Indiana Jones aspect of the story, which I find so captivating. And then look, within a few minutes, he does a pretty good rendition, doesn't he, of the Heracles and the Hermes herms. And then you see the drawing by Boutier, 1820. And they also found a hand with an apple in it. This is what I loved. Boutier, and then also the French consul on the island, who he immediately ran up to see, gave him the drawing, said, "You have to come down to this field. You have to see this statue. It's so beautiful." Why would they do this? Why would they care? Because if they could get beautiful statues, especially original Greek pieces, back to Paris, they would be famous, they would be able to give a gift to the king, and they would help replenish the Louvre, which had recently lost a great deal of art. What is amazing is that Boutier, the consul, and there were like six or seven captains came in the next week. They were all coming in and out of the harbor of Melos. They all looked, and this is Brest's actual, Louis Brest's quote, "A Venus has been found with the apple of discord in her hand." This was found maybe 10 yards away from the actual statue, but when they saw the statue and they saw a bit of the twist, what they call the contrapposta in her body, and they saw the hand, they knew that it was the Venus from the famous Judgment of Paris story. And these are soldiers. These are sailors who recognized it immediately. That's thrilling for me. How many of our soldiers would be able to do that today? Within a couple days, another ship came in, and another great character out of French history, I believe his first name was Louis Dumont d'Urville. He comes down, and he goes into the cave, and he helps actually find the second half, and he does some drawings. Let's see. He's the one who draws up here. He writes the inscription as exactly as possible. And what it says, briefly in English, is that I, the owner of this gymnasium, have commissioned this beautiful statue and the two gods with it. Isn't that mysterious? It's like the owner of Gold's Gym commissioning a statue of Greta Garbo for the foyer, just to inspire you a little bit before you go in and make some do some lifts, right? This is pretty sophisticated stuff. But when you think that how fast all of this was disappearing in lime kilns and the whole depredations of time and so on, it's really impressive to me that this fellow who went on to be a war hero in the Greek War, he explored in Antarctica, great, great character. How, and there, this is an image in the Montparnasse Cemetery today in Paris, and the inscription reads, "The Discoverer of the Venus de Milo." This guy, when he got back to Paris, took complete credit for discovering the statue. Vautier and none of the others got any credit. And he lived off this for the rest of his life. So this, I'm going to keep circling back on some of these themes, which always fascinate me. It's what I call the mystery of the territoriality of creativity. Who gets credit for what? It's a really mysterious territory, isn't it? I've been in a lot of film rooms. When it gets down, we've finished the documentary. I've worked on 18 films now besides my books. And this is the day you dread, when you sit around and say, all right, who gets the writing credit? Who gets the camera credit over here? Fights, battles, oh my God. And you thought this was all up for art, right? No, wrong. So this is what they fall in love with, this gorgeous statue. The question is, when was she carved? What is the story behind her? If you go to the Louvre today, you see her in the center in a niche. And here, everybody walks past it. There are no signs to tell you this is the original Herm of Heracles. This is Hermes. This is another one of Hermes. Here's the hand with the ball, the apple of discord. And there's no sign there. We'll get into some of the politics later, but the Louvre has been very uncomfortable about this statue and the whole story for almost 200 years about it. It's one of the great mysteries of art. So there's the missing foot and the hand. So what is it that they found? If you go to the site today, I've been there four times now. I spent many months at Milos interviewing people at the museum, fishermen. What do you think happened to her arms? Oh, they fell off when they took her down to the ship. You know, she's really big. She's 6'8", in case you don't know. This is one robust woman, I'm telling you. So they were saying, three mules couldn't get her down the hill to the ship, and so they rolled her down the hill, and her arms snapped off. There are all these stories. I heard 20, 30 different stories. It'll all be in the book. It's pretty funny. But here, in three languages, here was found the Venus. And this is where she was found. And I was able to piece this together after many visits because in 2003, I wrote a book on the history of the Olympics, the Olympic Odyssey, which the U.S. Olympic Committee actually bought copies for to give to every American athlete who went over for the 2004 games. Why? Because it emphasized arete, excellence, not the obsession with winning and gold, but the excellent life. And because of all that research, I found out that there were 300 of these in ancient Greece. Every major city of any renown, any importance, had a gymnasium. Why? This is the running track. This is where she was found, right here. Up here is the temple, and over here was the theater. You see what this is? It's a triangle. This is an image of the well-lived life. Why? When you walked into the gym in the morning, you walked past the statue of Heracles, Aphrodite, and Hermes, the god of strength, because you needed to be strong as an athlete. Speed, Hermes represented speed. He was a great runner. There are all these myths about him running against Heracles and so on. But she was actually the prominent one, because the notion was, if you wrote, you had to have beauty in your poetry. if you were an architect, you had to have a numinous beauty in your architecture. If you were an athlete, it wasn't enough just to win. You had to be a beautiful athlete. So you walked past images of mind, body, and soul every time you entered the gymnasium. That's what a gym would have looked like. And here is that little design. And this is in the 300 major cities in Greece. How many times have you heard mind, body, spirit, right? It's an ideal of sorts. It's come back. It actually came back when the games were revived in 1896. And that motto of living the well-lived life, cultivating your mind, cultivating your body, cultivating your spirit or your soul, was adopted by Harvard. And then it went and spread out all across America, courtesy of John Dewey and others. And it all came from this notion that the ideal day is spent in the morning at the temple. Or the temple was here. The afternoon was spent in the gymnasium, working out, wrestling, always to music, by the way. All athletics were performed to music because it was all about rhythm. Just like it is today. When I grew up playing ball in the streets of Detroit, we never played ball without Motown. I swear, we had these little battery-operated cassette players, and we always played ball to Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye. Right? Yeah. And then in the evening, you would go see a play to exercise your mind. So in one day, you have exercised mind, body, and soul. The alternate was if there wasn't a play on that night, you didn't want to go to the theater, you went to a symposium, which in ancient Greek means drinking party. No extra charge for that little ditty. So in some translations, it's the golden ball, it's the apple of discord. So what's the story? I finally found a painting. The girl is very hard to capture, but if you remember the story, there's the wedding of Peleus and Thetis, the mother of Achilles, and Zeus here invites all the gods and goddesses, handful of mortals, invites everybody except her. This is Eris, E-R-I-S, the goddess of strife. The goddess of discord, also the goddess of competition. On the upside, she embodied just that edge where you have to have a little, even discord in music, right? You have some discord in sports, too. That's in theater. This is what gives you tension. In the story, she gets her revenge because she isn't invited to the party. Like that crazy uncle who always gets drunk at the weddings, and so you say, oh, do we have to invite him, right? She's the one that they didn't invite. So see the ball here? This is the apple of discord. She throws it into the middle of the party, and Athena, Hera, and Aphrodite all converge on the ball at once. They look down, they pick it up, and it says, for the fairest, for the most beautiful. And they start arguing. No, it's mine. She meant to throw it to me. No, it's mine. Then because they're arguing, discord is suddenly in the room. Isn't that, see the play of words with this? So what do? They turn to Zeus and they say, you decide. Now, guys, if you've ever been asked to judge a beauty contest, what would you do at this moment? Hail a taxi, right? Right, yeah. He does the next best thing. There's Zeus with a thunderbolt. He calls for Hermes, and he says, get me out of this jam. That's my wife. She's asking me to judge you with Athena and Aphrodite. What are you going to do? And so it's a very beautiful motif here. Hermes thinks very quickly, and he's thinking, okay, judge. This is the world's first beauty contest. Essentially, that's what this is. It's the world's first beauty contest, and it hasn't gotten much prettier since, so to speak, in terms of competition and judging and so on. So he's thinking, who could judge this? And what comes to mind is Paris. Paris is the prince of Troy. And if you remember the story, when he's born, there's a prophecy that says, someday King Priam's son will bring the war to Troy down. So when Paris is born, he's exiled immediately out of Troy and out into the countryside, a place called Mount Ida. And so he lives out with the goats till he's 17. He's just living all alone, just him and the goats, all alone. And one morning, Hermes appears with the golden apple here, and he says, Zeus wants you to be the judge. And he's heard that Paris is a very fair judge. So there's this really intriguing play on words. Even Elaine Scarry says, beauty and justice are always in turmoil together. Isn't that something? From the very beginning, beauty has always had a tumultuous relationship with justice. Oh, it's not fair that she got better looks than me. Oh, it isn't fair that my brother got bigger muscles than me. We still talk in those terms. It's not fair that he can play as fast as he does, whatever it might be, right? And so he's been a judge of athletic contests, a judge of sporting events, all kinds of things. So he's the obvious choice to decide. And lickety-split, the three goddesses, Hera, Athena, and Aphrodite, all appear right before him, and Hermes says, you have to judge. Who's the most beautiful? And the first thing that he says is, well, please disrobe. So 17 years old. Right. These are goddesses, and he wants to be able to judge who's the most beautiful. But what happens then is very intriguing. We're talking a lot of psychodynamic language here. Jung loved this story. So first, Hera says, you pick me, I will make you the most famous man in the realm. And Paris says, I'm happy out here. I don't want to be back in the palace. What's fame to a shepherd? I don't want that. Athena says, I'll make you the most mightiest warrior. You know who Paris's brother is? Hector, who's the great hero of the Iliad. He doesn't want to stand up against Hector. And then Aphrodite here begins to disrobe. This is a great motif in sculpture and painting. The moment of disrobing. It's the moment of display. She, according to this, some of the most beautiful poetry of antiquity describes this moment where she slowly lets her hemacia, it's called sometimes, or sometimes her magic girdle, it's another way to phrase it, drops. And you see they're getting the eye contact right here. This is what you get with the Venus de Milo in marble. It's the same look. Because she says, if you pick me, I will give you the hand of the most beautiful woman in the world, Helen of Sparta. But more than that, I will make her fall in love with you. And that's where we have to pause for a second, because as Bettany Hughes, a wonderful Irish writer on myths, she's written a magnificent book on Helen of Troy. Her new book is on Socrates. She makes a very strong case that Aphrodite and Helen have both been maligned for at least 2,500 years with this story. That instead of her being a vainglorious, narcissistic goddess, only concerned with her own beauty, and Helen being so self-absorbed she would allow herself to be seduced by this callow young youth, Bettany says that the two of them are about beauty and desire. And the key to me, for the mystery of the story and then the statue, as we slowly circle back to her, is I think this moment right here is the first in human history, at least recorded, in which a man chooses beauty and happiness over power and glory. It's a very mighty moment. Up until this point, men have always picked what? And most men have picked it ever since as well. Power and glory, power and glory. This is a moment of complete volition. He has to decide. He loves the fact that this is the most beautiful woman, and now she's trying to bribe him, but what is she saying? She's saying, I will be sure that you safely sail from Troy to Sparta, and I will ensure that this legendary beauty, everyone knew who Helen was, I'll make sure she actually falls in love with you. So a couple things are happening here. One is, in this a beautiful new book. Blanking on the title. I'll have to give it to you later. Called A Beauty is the Promise of Happiness. It's one of the prime source books for me in here. And if you want the author, email me later on it. And there she makes a great case for the echo of this painting, this story, this sculpture, having ramifications that ripple out and ramify all the way up to this day. That the beautiful building, the beautiful piece of music, the beautiful artwork, the beautiful conversation, the beautiful woman is also a promise of happiness. It's at the heart of our relationships, but also the entire advertising business. If you buy this car, if you swig this beer, you'll get the girl. Literally, girl, in all these cases. And what, in turn, after that, you'll also be happy if you get that washing machine. Right? So the beauty leads to the desire. The beauty lures you with the desire, and then happiness is promised. So that's a formula that begins here. And we're still living it out to this day. Here, there's a Chronic the Elders version, very knightly, very medieval version, you can see. This is Paris as a medieval knight. Cézanne actually had a go at this. And in here, you get some of the violent forces here that ended up producing the whole Trojan War, because when Aphrodite brings Helen and Paris together, she also supports Troy for the rest of that war. And all the symbolism, behind that, but then the other two goddesses are incensed that Paris picked Aphrodite over them. And so you get this whole other aspect of jealousy is also what Aphrodite ignites. James Hillman has this wonderful phrase called the Aphroditic smile. I think it's his own translation, but what it refers to is this kind of quality that happens when Aphrodite enters a story or a poem or a painting. When Aphrodite walks into the room, beauty walks in. Goldness, there's a radiance, but there's also a price. Somebody somewhere will always resent that beauty, that glow. Everyone's attention turning to that star-like quality. And I think Cézanne captures that brilliantly here with almost angry colors. And then Renoir's version of this. You see, even Hermes looks rather feminine up here, doesn't he? And then Paris, he's kind of looking pleadingly. See, he's offering, this is the exchange right here that you get with the Venus de Milo statue. You see? He's handing her the apple, so the apple is in the hand in the statue, and that's why she's longingly looking in the distance. She's looking at Paris, give her the apple. And the others are turning away, already angry. So there's another version of the Venus. Did you know Rumor was a goddess? Yeah, I just found that out in this research too. Ossa, was one of her names, and she was winged. There are only a couple of images of her in antiquity, and this is one of them. So when you think, what do the Irish say? If they gossip with you, they're gossiping about you. An old Irish proverb. And so how does rumor enters the room? As if on wings, doesn't it? And then off again. And that's what happened on the island of Melos. When Yorgos, the peasant farmer, begins to tell the neighbors and then the civic leaders, oh, I think I found this statue. And they're saying, well, how much did that Frenchman offer you? 800 piastres? Well, that thing's worth 8 million. And so the negotiation started, and everything went a bit wacky at that point. The D'Urville went off to Constantinople, which actually ruled the island at the time, and he met with a French diplomat, and the diplomat said, at any cost, get that statue, because we have to get it to France. It'll get me out of Constantinople. It'll make me very famous. So this is archetypally what we begin to talk about here is the phenomenon of reflected glory. You get it when you identify with your sports teams. You you enjoy this, you indulge in it. If you say, hey, man, Marvin Gaye came from Detroit. See, I'm indulging in the whole mythos of reflected glory. And that's what begins to happen with our story of the Venus de Milo. There's a backdoor deal given between the civic leaders of Greece and of Milos, and they sell her to the Russians. And when Marcellus and the others come back with the news, we're taking this for France, they see right here that the Venus is being lowered onto a Russian ship, and the French officers come up and say, if you don't put her back on our ship to sail for France, we're going to turn our cannons on you. So this is a whole part, you'll have to read the book, as they say, to get into this. But what starts to happen is the fight for this reflected glory that goes on to this day. Who gets the new Frank Gehry contract? Who gets the new Calatrava contract for the new museum? You see, so we civic people, we continue to do this. The New York Times today has this great article about how unusual it is for Seattle to have a college football stadium on the water. And everybody in Seattle is so proud of it. Yes, great example of it. Highly recommend that movie too. So, to cut an epic story slightly shorter, the French get the girl, as Joe Campbell used to say, they get the blonde, and she gets on the ship and sails away. This is a little mosaic of that famous ship that sails off to France. From this harbor, in which, by the way, the last time I was there, I was staying in a little house down here near the pier where she was taken and sailed off to France. And I got an email from the submarine owner of the fellow who found the Titanic. And he said, I've been looking at your website, and I hear that you're looking for the arms of the Venus de Milo. And I emailed right back, from Milos, a little cafe in Milos, it's a metaphor. Or as Campbell used to say, it's a metaphor. Right? And he writes back and he says, well, now I'll come over there and I'll bring my submarine and we'll find it. And I'm saying, it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor for the missing arms of the world. And he says, well, that means you probably found them, didn't you? And you just don't want me to know. This went on and on and on and on. Finally, we had to shut it off. But it shows you how the legend continues to this day. So why was everybody so hot about this? A little lithograph of the Louvre around 1845. Remember, she arrives. It's kind of astonishing to me. She's found in April 1820. 13 months later, May 1821, she's in the Louvre. Now, you think she's been buried in a cave for 1,500 years. And within a year, she's suddenly in the Louvre as the most famous statue in the most famous museum. Well, why was this important? Here's a great painting of the Salon Carré, and you can see this is just almost the French boasting to the rest of the world, just the chock-a-block way that they had to display all of the paintings, in which was essentially the old palace. It was the Louvre was a fortress, then turned into the royal palace, and then in 1793 at the Revolution, turned into the world's first major museum. And by the time the statue was discovered, 5 years had gone by, which had changed everything about the Louvre. It was the greatest museum, and then the British Museum got the Elgin Marbles. And the whole rivalry between France and Britain got stoked all over again. And then something worse happened, at least for the French. Napoleon, between 1793 and 1815, not only conquered half of Europe, he also looted 250,000 works of art. So he was drawing them, right? And then he would bring them back. And that's how the Louvre went from just a small collection of the aristocrats and the royalty's art, that's the origin of that museum, to having the greatest works of art that were just cherry-picked by his generals and his officers all across Europe. And so, including the Apollo Belvedere, this was considered the greatest statue of antiquity before the Venus de Milo. And you see, this is an image that gives you all the crowds, royalty, aristocrats coming to look at these massive paintings that were mostly looted from the rest of Europe. So he is then, if you remember your history, and this is one of the pieces looted. This was the statue that was discovered in Rome that made Michelangelo want to be a sculptor. He was standing there as they pulled it out of the ground in the Forum. And then Wellington defeats Napoleon at Waterloo. And in the first case that I know, maybe you guys know another case, this is the first recorded case of restitution in history. Because he immediately gets together with all the other allies, and they say, Napoleon's got to go, but more than that, you have to give back the art. We're talking restitution is a huge issue. It's a big one for me in my new book, Beyond Forgiveness here. Can you make restitutions for slavery? Can, in apartheid, can the South African whites make any kind of restitution? See, we're still dealing with this now. This is the first case, legally. And what happened then was that the French gave back 25,000 pieces of art. Not everything had its papers. As a provenance, I think that's what it's called, provenance. So a lot of the work that was there, they just didn't know where to send it back to. It didn't have any paper trail. But they sent back 25,000 works of art, and if you read some of the reports from the day, there are phrases like, went to the Louvre today, and it was bereft of beauty. There are all these interesting phrases in the journals, in the newspapers of the time, where the French are humiliated that this has happened. They didn't just lose the war, they were humiliated all across Europe. That's 1815. That's why in 1820, when the Venus de Milo was discovered, they desperately had to get it to Paris to get some pride back and to get the attention away from the Elgin marbles, or as the Greeks say, the Parthenon marbles from the British Museum. And it was in comparison to what? This is where the Indiana Jones aspect turns out. This is a spectacular image of Hermes. I'm sorry, it's not, it should be much brighter, but this is Praxiteles, who is considered the greatest sculptor of antiquity. This is really, he's buffed, but the statue's also buffed. Also, it's a glorious shade of flesh like marble. It's a miracle to behold. But it's one of only a handful of originals that we have from ancient Greece. And that's what the Louvre thought that they were getting with the Venus. Here's Praxiteles' Venus de Milo. And my feeling is this is what the sculptor of the Venus de Milo had in mind when he carved what we now know as the Venus. He loved the story, the Apple of Discord, and he loved this mysterious sculptor from, we now know, the west of Turkey, what is now Turkey, had in mind. He also was bold enough to carve a nude. This is the first. This is a copy. This isn't the original, but this is the first copy of the first nude goddess in history. Up until 350, all the goddesses were covered with nighties, veils that, it's astonishing works of sculpture. We can carve a veil and see what's behind the veil. It's mind-boggling to me that you can do that. But the fact that then it was a big issue, even the poets and philosophers, is it proper to carve a disrobed goddess? You see all these papers, and finally Praxiteles breaks through. And that's what inspired, I'm pretty sure, here's another version of her, and you can see in the Venus de Milo just in the background. You see her back here? So this statue inspired the Venus de Milo right here. And if they got the Venus from that same period, it would seal their fame, their reputation. All of French culture could bask in the glory of this statue. Okay? And then the mystery deepens again. When the statue arrived at the Louvre, it had a full plinth here at the base. And on the plinth here, it reads, I, Alexandros of Antioch, which is a little town in western Turkey, on the meander. That's where you get the word meander. The meander is a river in West Turkey. I, Alexandros of Meander on the Antioch, son of Menides. There's a whole rigmarole that goes through this. I carved this statue. To me, it's so touching to have a phrase like that that was carved about 100 BC. That's roughly the time. And there are so few attributions in any of the old art. That's why a lot of it feels anonymous. Who carved what? Who painted what? Who wrote what? We knew. But you know what happened? When it was unveiled in 1821 in front of King Louis XVIII, this was gone. It mysteriously disappeared, and it's never been found again. An art student just happened to sketch this for a famous painter of the time who wanted to see it. You couldn't email him a JPEG, so you had to say, hey, can you get a student to run over there and just do a quick sketch for me? Why is this so damn important, the mystery of the inscription? Well, Antioch, the big thing was, if the Venus de Milo was a classical statue, this would make it the greatest discovery in all of antiquity. That's a pretty big thing. That's a pretty big thing to say. The most famous discovery of antiquity. But that would be 350 BC or so. And to say that I lived in Antioch on the Meander, Antioch wasn't founded until 150. That means it's at least 200, maybe 250 years later. Now, it's the same statue, right? But it's a different provenance. And this was destroyed. And so for 100 years, the statue was on display there as the greatest statue of all of antiquity, greater than Praxiteles, greater than anybody else. And the French won't talk about it to this day. I was just there again in September trying to interview people in the archives, and they were saying, this is slander, this is cultural slander. Well, here's about 1895, somebody, for 70 years, people were saying, what did she look like? Can we restore her? Can we restore the arms? What did she look like? Here's one possibility. She's here with the ball, and because the arm would have been so heavy, probably had the pedestal there. And what she's doing, very delicate move that is so touching when you see the statues. She's letting her robe drop for Paris, because Paris has just said, will you disrobe for me, right? So I can see just how beautiful you are. And this is an ancient and really a gorgeous motif in old Greek art. It's the dropping of the clothes so a woman or a goddess can slip into a bath and slip out again. Auguste Rodin, when he had a slight period when he was struggling with his art, he went to the Louvre every day, and he walked around the statue to be inspired. Consider the Venus from any profile. You're admiring a beauty that invokes the eternal. He wrote about it, and it was actually reprinted in the New York Times. I will walk around her. So let me just show you a few images here as we go into the last few minutes. That's the golden Aphrodite. That was one of her epithets. There's the gaze. She's looking, I believe, into the eyes of Paris, who has just given her the award. He has actually said, you are the most beautiful. And this is, it's such a human moment. There was so much dynamism in that face. There are a lot of other Venuses and Aphrodites who just, frankly, look insipid or sentimental or treacly. This is a strong woman. A lot of focus, she's the goddess of fertility, also lust. She was a patron of mothers and childbirth. There was probably a gold band around her head here, which has long since disappeared, but gold is a color, Hillman writes about this beautifully, associated with her and her husband, Hephaestus. Because gold represents, you know more about the alchemy than me, but she's associated with it. This is part of the mystery to me. This little turn of the hips here, that's what the sculptor had to do to have her leaning forward to accept the apple. And what that does is bring tremendous sexuality into this piece. Her hips are turned around, and I think it's part of the trance. You go in that room, and you have to walk around her. There's a kind of centrifugal force. You just can't stand and stare. And part of it is because there's so much torque and tension in that one movement. It's just genius. She's bared her breasts, which in ancient Ireland, but also in ancient Greece, was often a gesture of a woman for compassion. Sometimes in a battle, a woman or a goddess would move forward into the line of battle and bare the breasts and say, "We want to surrender. Would you spare the women and children?" So there's a lot of beautiful symbolism inside every feature of the Venus. A wonderful line by Sappho: when Aphrodite's feet touch the ground, grass and flowers grow all around her. Yeah, beautiful. She's also called the Aphrodite Callipygian. Now, you're going to have to buy a copy of Wordcatcher to see what that word means, but it means beautiful buttocks. So this is Callipygian. A great word. And it was strong back. Some people, Kenneth Clark and others have said, the most beautiful back ever sculpted. So just wonderful details here. So just a few. Colosso, again, my wonderful line. The gold she radiates, which is one of the great properties of beauty, as opposed to this. This is a much later piece. It's called Venus with the Sandal. And to me, there's no dynamism here whatsoever. It's a very sentimentalized view. But what's the one thing that's curious is that this is psychodynamically what happens when Aphrodite or a sexy woman, someone with sexual drive and pizzazz and desire, walks into a room. This is what happens to all the men. They grow horns, right? Pandemonium reigns. This is the god Pan, is the satyr who's trying to seduce her. And she won't have, look, she's looking right by him. Yeah, get away from me. Interesting line by Jung. Beauty is the mediator which should restore the primal unity. All experience goes to show that beauty needs her opposite, which is part of the mystery of why the most beautiful goddess is married to the ugliest of mortals. That's a whole other seminar we could do. It's quite something. She's married to Hephaestus, who has a limp. He's considered the ugliest. He's the god of the forge. He has bribed her and Zeus with gold to win her hand. But as Jung and so many others write, Jeanette Paris has a beautiful essay in Aphrodite in which she says roughly the same thing, that all beauty needs balance. Beauty without balance, like Julia Roberts marrying Lyle Lovett, helps bring you back down to earth. And her lover, of course, is Mars. So from the very get-go, you've got this fascinating dynamic. And again, Jeanette Paris writes on this, if you want to follow this, that there is always, she writes, love is a battlefield. Isn't that a great line? Love is a battlefield, and it's personified in this relationship between Venus and Mars, or Aphrodite and Ares. Carl Jung says, where love rules, there is no will to power. Where power predominates, there love is lacking. The one is the shadow of the other. So Mars is the god of war and violence, but like that wonderful play in the 70s, women who make love to men to take the war out of them. Do you remember that play? It's a little bit what's happening here. His heart is softened and tenderized by his affair with her. And there are many versions of it, but one of the children, they have at least four children together, Aphrodite and Mars. One child is called Harmony. Very interesting. If you bring together two opposites, you create harmony. Isn't that curious? Another child is Eros. Out of love and war, out of beauty and war, comes love. Think of the dynamic there. But two of the other children, one is Phobos, as in phobia. He's the god of fear. Comes out of the concupiscent. Don't get to use that word very often. Relationship between love and war. And Deimos, who's the god of terror. Here is all those properties that can come out of a tumultuous love affair are personified in the very children of the goddess. And then the chants, Watteau. Watteau's beautiful, beautiful painting here. This is the chants for happiness here. Look at that face. Hermes is saying, listen to her, listen to her. She's going to give you Helen, right? Another curious offset, Hermes, when Aphrodite and Hermes get together, they make rock and roll. No, that's another song. They make the hermaphrodite. So that's the dark side of the lustful aspect of her. She's got at least 9 lovers, according to my count. And then as the wrap up here, as we get into the whole business of Helen. So you've got this Paris sailing across from Troy, and he comes into the palace of Menelaus. Menelaus gives him a great feast and then says, I'm going off for the weekend here. Would you take care of my wife? Just make sure she's okay. And in wink, wink, nod, nod, right? And as one of the descriptions goes, when after Menelaus has left, the ships are gone, Helen sends a message to Paris. Paris walks into the bedroom, and the line by Ovid is, when Paris sees her marble white breasts, he is lost forever. And it's really an enchanting line to describe that moment of physical beauty that puts you into a spell. So this is way beyond volition, and I think that's part of the symmetry of the story, that there is a spell that has been cast here, and it's a way that the Greeks said, love is beyond volition. There is a spell, an enchantment here. And in one of the great origins of the story of Helen, is usually that she's the child of Leda, remember in the whole Leda and the Swan story, but there's an older story than that, that Zeus and Ananke, the goddess of necessity, actually have a bit of a fling. And Ananke becomes pregnant with Helen. And Hermes takes the seed and plants it in Leda. This is the first in vitro fertilization example in history. But what is it saying symbolically? That Helen, the face that launched 1,000 ships, the most beautiful woman in all of antiquity, she's the daughter of necessity. Beauty is a necessity in life. It's not a luxury. It's not a self-indulgence. Beauty is as necessary as breath. And then there were 4 different versions of Helen. She's under a spell. Why would she have fallen for this ruse? Why would she have been vulnerable? The quick backup on this, she's had 2 other lovers before Paris. Theseus, when she was a young girl, she was raped at 9 by Theseus, the king of Athens. And then she was chosen, probably in a deal about land, and did not want to really marry Menelaus. And her first night together, the way it's written, is she's raped by Menelaus, who wants her because of all the land that she represents through her family. So it's not just that she is a loose hussy, right? As we've been told. Instead, she sees Paris and she sees the possibility of love for the very first time, because he is always described as the fair Paris, which means he's beautiful as well. You see how symmetrical this is? Each of them is triggered, catalyzed, galvanized by an image of love, which brings desire and then the hope for human happiness. The Trojan War, of course, is ignited because of this, and I'll give you one line from the Iliad. Helen goes out walking on the ramparts one night, wondering, should I go back? Should I go back? Can I help stop this carnage? And 2 soldiers happen to see her with the moon reflecting off of her neck, and they are so stunned by her beauty. One soldier turns to the other and says, the war must go on. And that's been interpreted so many times through the years, Robert Graves and Albert Camus and so many others, as saying, this is part of the Greek miracle, that you fight for beauty. Beauty is worth dying for, because there is joy. Robert Johnson has written beautifully on this, that joy is what comes out of this relationship. You know, when Psyche and Eros have a child, the name of the child is joy. Direct descendant of beauty. So what role does she play today? I have the last 5 slides here. I just told this story in Paris. I just led a literary tour around Paris. When the Nazis took over Paris and France, they had happened to them what Napoleon had done to Europe previously. They came in, and by loose counts, 250 to 300,000 works of art were stolen by the Nazis, crated, put on trains, and sent off to salt mines in Austria, to Castle Neuschwanstein. Mad King Ludwig Neuschwanstein was actually the repository for tens of thousands of works of art. You know how we got them back? This woman, Rose Villain. This is a great feature film waiting to be made. This is one of the great untold stories of the 20th century. She was the curator at the Jeu de Paume. Remember that beautiful little museum near the Louvre? And they called her in. The Nazis called her in. Everybody else, they fired or executed or exiled. She was so efficient, they had her record every painting, every mosaic, every piece of sculpture. She wrote them all out by hand all day long. What they didn't know is that she understood German. And she knew then where all the art was going. She was a member of the French Resistance. She worked for the Nazis during the day, and then she went home, and she sent out messages all across France where the art was going. All the Chagalls and the Vermeers are going out to this town, and the Picassos and the Matisses are going over there. That's how we were able to find them at the end of the war. This is a way we risk our lives for beauty. That's part of the whole Helen of Troy story. One guy who operated one of the trains and got the art back was saying, "Why did you risk your life for all this art?" And he said, "If we didn't save this art, we would have disgraced our ancestors and we would have been just as bad as those monsters." See, this is the same dynamic played out. The Blue Venus by Yves Klein, Salvador Dali's version, a little souvenir store in Milos. This is a feminist view of the corset. Beauty can be a trap. It can be a corset. Here's Aphrodite with a cell phone for a cell phone ad. In front of the Seagram's building, this is the modern Venus. In front of the Seagram's. I was just in Paris, and there's a play. The men are from Mars, women are from Venus. It's turned into a one-man play. This is a coffee ad here. Here we have Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio and Arthur Miller, all in boxes, caught, trapped in the labyrinth of seduction, desire, beauty. Marilyn Monroe reading James Joyce's Ulysses. We've just discovered from her recently published book of letters and her journals, she was a voracious reader. She once said, "Hollywood will give you $1 million for your body and 10 cents for your soul." Beauty can be a trap, can be a corset. Marlene Dietrich, Blonde Venus. Look, see that? American Beauty, the Oscar winner. Beauty and the Beast. We might show a little bit of that tomorrow during the workshop. Beauty competition at the Biennial in Paris. Beauty contests here. The less said, the better. The myth of travel is totally predicated on the myth of beauty and how that kind of beauty will bring you happiness. If you go to Thailand, if you go to China, there's Castle Neuschwanstein in Bavaria. This is where a lot of the art was hidden from the Louvre. Pan Am, this is a new TV series. Yeah, canned already? Oh, is that right? And then Thomas Cook, posters. All promising beauty, promising happiness. Rusty Schweiker, the astronaut, when he was floating up in space, you could hear him on one of the old tapes saying, "God, it's beautiful." And you could hear that catch in his breath. You know why that's important? Because the Greek word, the aesthetics, is based on the Greek to seize the breath. And if you want a good definition of beauty, beauty is what takes your breath away. If it doesn't take your breath away, it's pretty, it's entertainment, It can be illustrative. Choose your adjectives. But the real thing, does that make sense? It seizes you, catches your breath. Santorini. And then Ansel, sometimes I arrive just when God's ready to have someone click the shutter. Isn't that marvelous? And there's Ansel. I've become friends with this family, and they tell me the great story. When he was 20, he had a huge decision to make. He had been playing classical piano, and his mother and his grandmother and his aunts, they all wanted him to go into music. It was more predictable. But he had been playing around with a camera since he was 15, and went his first trip to Yosemite, and he had to make this very dramatic announcement to them. It says, I'm choosing photography. And they said, oh, no, no, that's a terrible career move, terrible. And he said, well, the piano can capture, they said, this, the camera can't capture the soul the way that music does. And Ansel's response was, well, maybe the camera can't capture the soul, but maybe the photographer can. And then that became his goal for the rest of his life, to capture the beauty. You can feel it right there. Capture the beauty that takes your breath away, that confirms the radiance and the numinous power of the world. He once wrote to Alfred Stieglitz, I think the world is afraid of beauty. Beautiful letter. And today we're still, I could not believe the recent phenomena, being in Paris just in September after my tour. Because now, because of the iPhone, people are walking up in front of her. This guy's got an ordinary camera, but I was there for 8 straight days, 8 hours a day, writing and so on. And the phenomena that I saw was, people would go, they would look at the statue for 5 or 6 seconds, and then they would immediately turn around, and they were taking photos of themselves in front of the statue, which is another, what? Reflected glory. Remember? It's amazing. So there she is in the full glory, back in her niche, so to speak. The aphroditic smile. There, I think she's been humbled by this moment when she receives the apple. I could look at that face forever. And then finally, the last image, thank you for bearing with me here, is that Annie Dillard, one of my favorite writers, writes in her book on the writing life, she says, given what we know, how should we live? Isn't that something? Yes, thank you for the backup there, sister. Given what we know, given all of our intelligence and our reasoning, but how do we live? And Rollo May, in my last interview with him some years ago, he said, the way that you live is by surrounding yourself with beauty, because beauty is then what brings out the beauty from inside you. So music, sculpture, travel, art. And he says, that's pure Socrates. You know, when Socrates, he was a day away from taking the hemlock, and he asked for a flute. And they said, why do you want a flute? And he says, just think about how much I could learn in 24 hours. So the value here is that the beauty creates a desire in us. The desire offers the promise. Maybe, this will bring me some happiness and some contentment. So we've got a couple of paintings here about the good life, La Bonne Vie, La Coupole, in a wonderful cafe in Paris, one of my favorite in the world, that has always enshrined that because of the value on beautiful conversation. In a great cafe, you dress beautifully, you smell beautifully. You know, Aphrodite's the goddess of perfume. Perfume is a very mythic, potent power. And so what I've always found in a place like this, I wasn't there when Josephine Baker walked her leopard in, which she did in 1927, according to legend. But I've been there many a night when there was so much life there, and nobody had a cell phone out, and nobody went for a TV, but they were there because of their love of the beautiful architecture, the beautiful food, the beautiful coffee, the wine, but it was the beauty, the friendships as well, which brought all together, gives us at least the possibility of a good life. Thank you very much.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.